Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 441, titled Pecunia Nervus Belli, Part 2, being recorded on January 11th of 2004. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older programs available at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Note for people who find this admittedly very pedantic style of broadcasting to be kind of tough to handle, there are detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs available within a week or so of the airing of this of the broadcast. They will be in the For the Record section. The description for 441 will be in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of the program. Now, returning to our political and economic analysis of September 11th and related events, we were talking about globalization. And although globalization is a phenomenon that is generally portrayed as something that is taking place in the late 20th century, in fact, it was underway in a big way. And I think in order to understand the structural economic relationships that have brought us to this situation, the situation we find ourselves in the year of our Lord 2004, I think it's important to understand World War I, what happened afterward in terms of global economic investment, and how that in turn determined what happened in World War II, and then how the Cold War basically resulted in the cementing and concretization of the political and economic effects of World War II. World War I, the existing order in Europe, basically committed suicide. The First World War could be viewed as a 17th century European aristocratic duel fought at 50 paces with heavy artillery, machine guns, and poison gas. The result was predictable. It destroyed the industrial labor force of all of the manufacturing powers of Europe. It bankrupted those powers who basically spent all of their capital investing in the engines of war. And it basically destroyed the old order in Europe. Down came the Habsburg dynasty, down came the Holland, that was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, down came the Romanovs in Russia, down came the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, and down came the Hohenzollerns in Germany. Britain and France were bankrupt. The United States, on the other hand, was in very good shape. It was World War I that turned us from a lender to a creditor nation. The U.S. financial institutions loaned the warring powers of Europe all of the capital to wage their wars. At the end of the war, our industrial labor force was intact, and we were in an economic boom. Now, something we talked about in For the Record 406 was the Webb-Parmalee Act. Although Theodore Roosevelt had helped to implement antitrust regulations making monopolies, or trusts, an entire industry dominated by a single company, illegal in the United States, a loophole, the Webb-Parmalee Act, made it possible for the robber barons of the United States to invest in what were called cartels, basically international monopolies. Because they wanted to escape the regulation, the antitrust regulation at home, America's power elite, the robber barons, the industrialists and financiers of which the Bush family were a significant element, invested in heavy industry and municipalities in Germany, Italy, and Japan, basically. The United States in the 1920s was experiencing a huge industrial boom as a result of the automobile and the new invention of radio. It was a speculative boom, but whereas capitalism can only succeed when capital is invested in such a way as to generate more capital, instead of investing in the American infrastructure, the American power elite in the 1920s invested in infrastructure in Germany, Japan, and Italy. This not only helped to precipitate the Great Depression in the United States, because the U.S. did not have its own capital reinvested in its infrastructure, but the forfeiting by the German municipalities and corporations of the German bonds basically helped to collapse the stock market in 1929. The Hoot-Smalley Act, the Hoot-Smalley Tariff Act also helped to precipitate that, but basically it was because the U.S. invested in Germany, Italy, and Japan, primarily Germany and Japan, rather than the United States. The military power that surged all over Europe and all over Asia was the transmogrified capital power of the American industrial boom of the 1920s. It was invested in Germany and Japan and Germany surged all over Europe and Asia, respectively. Now, in terms of understanding what happened during that occupation, again, the force, the military force of Germany, which surged all over Europe, and the military force of Japan, which surged all over Asia, was the transmogrified economic power from the American industrial boom of the 1920s. In many broadcasts for the record, many For the Record broadcasts, and in miscellaneous archive show M11, M26, M42, in the first two RFA shows and in RFA number 10, I've talked about this industrial investment in the fascist powers of Europe. Various For the Record programs talk about it as well, For the Record 361. For the Record 426, 427, and 428 talk about it as well. In terms of understanding, again, what happened in World War II, globalization was underway in a big way by the end of World War I. The American robber barons, the American power elite, invested not in America, but in Japan and Germany after World War I. That transmogrified economic power surged all over the world, and then Japan and Germany used their occupation of Asia and Europe in order to basically loot the continents, respectively. The scale of that looting is one of the dominant factors in the contemporary world. First of all, let's look at Germany. We're going to refer now to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This book was authored by Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, Blowback, that we've used many times on this program. Now, of the amount of money, the amount of capital that was looted by the Germans from occupied Europe, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. In all, the British estimated that the Germans had extracted the equivalent of about $180 billion from occupied Europe as of 1943, including both direct levels for occupation costs and a variety of hidden techniques such as currency manipulation. These figures were based on financial statistics published by the Germans themselves and do not include estimates for wealth seized from the USSR and Greece. As such, even the $180 billion figure clearly underestimates the true total. And again, that's not what they took, that's less what they took from the USSR and Greece and what they took after 43. And that $180 billion is in 1940s dollars, early 40s dollars. That would be a huge, huge sum of money today. Now, in For the Record programs 290 and also in For the Record programs 426 and 427, we spoke about the powerful connections between the American industrial and financial elite and their counterparts in Japan, and in particular the American capitalization of Japan after the great Kanto earthquake of 1943. The amount of money stolen, the amount of wealth stolen by the Japanese from Asia was equally enormous. Just the amount of money in the Philippines under Operation Golden Lily, again discussed in For the Record 427 and 428, was placed at $100 billion. Turning to the book The Yamato Dynasty by Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave, we read, Golden Lily stripped Asia of currency, gold, platinum, silver, gems, jewelry, art, treasures, and religious artifacts, including more than a dozen solid gold Buddhas, each weighing more than a ton. According to Japanese who participated, some $100 billion worth of gold and gems was hidden at more than 200 sites in the Philippines when it became physically impossible to move the loot to Japan. So that's $100 billion that the Japanese stashed just in the Philippines. And again, that's $100 billion in early 1940s dollars as well. As we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 428, in turn, much of that loot was put into what became known as the Black Eagle Trust, a slush fund which was used for political manipulation in the post-World War II period. But what's important to understand in terms of looking at the background to what's taking place today is that globalization was already a fact after World War I, World War II, in turn, led to two huge capital flows into the coffers of Japan and Germany through their looting of occupied Asia and Europe, that basically done courtesy of the transmogrified economic power of the American industrial boom of the 1920s. Then, with the Cold War underway, with the Soviet Union occupying much of Eurasia, with China now having turned communist, Japan and Germany were seen as bulwarks against the expansion of communism. So several things took place. First of all, the same political orders basically were put back into power, minus their uniforms and minus a few of the more heinous offenders in both Japan and Germany. Beyond that, and more importantly perhaps for our current purposes, the economic status quo in Asia and Europe was maintained. That vast sum of loot that the Germans and Japanese took from Europe and Asia were allowed to remain in their coffers. We've spoken about the fact that under the Bormann Flight Capital Program, the German wealth was transferred into a series of corporate fronts in neutral countries, there to be utilized by the powerful German corporations, and that represented one of the foundation of German economic recovery. But it was within the context of the concretization of the political slash economic results of World War II, in order to approach what the leaders of this country saw as the Cold War, that basically the status quo was allowed to continue. And the connections between the German corporations and the German cartels and their American counterparts on the one hand, and in turn the Japanese corporations and the cartels, the Japanese portion of the cartels and their American counterparts, those relationships were precipitated into the post-war period. At a political level, the Trilateral Commission, which many people may be familiar with, is a manifestation of the concretization of the capital results of World War II, although it's been misrepresented by some right-wing conspiracy theorist, a sort of an international Zionist plutocracy, etc. It, in fact, is a very important institution and reflects the tripartite capital arrangement that resulted from World War II, with Japan and Germany having looted Asia and Europe. And within that context, the political order of the power elite in Germany and Japan were precipitated. We're going to turn now to the book briefly, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning. Veteran listeners to the program know who Paul Manning is, and we're going to review a couple of aspects from documents that Paul Manning presents in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published by Lyle Stewart in 1981. And this is from the basically reading what Paul Manning writes. This is about the meeting that took place in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine on August 10th of 1944. This is Paul Manning writing. A transcript of that meeting is in my possession. It is a captured German document from the files of the U.S. Treasury Department and states who was present and what was said as the economy of the Third Reich was projected onto a post-war profit-seeking track. And skipping down, this is SS Obergruppenführer Dr. Scheid. As an example, and he's discussing here their plans to reestablish their connections with their American cartel counterparts in order to perpetuate the post-war order. Quote, and again, this is from captured German documents that Paul Manning had from the files of the U.S. Treasury Department. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that, quote, patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated of New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern, unquote. Krupp now is ThyssenKrupp. It is the Thyssen firm that joined the Bush-Harriman business interests to the primary steel concern in Germany, and that relationship has been discussed in many programs as well. It was from that relationship that much of the Bush family's contemporary capital position accrued. Continuing here, he, Dr. Scheid, also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men present. Hamburg America Line was another of the Bush family Nazi businesses. So note here that it is a perpetuation of these cartel agreements, and the Bush family are at the core of the establishment of the Steel Cartel. It was that cartel, by the way, that led to the subversion of France in large measure. The Comité des Fauges in France were part of the Steel Cartel, of which the Thyssens were a primary element in Germany, and of which the Thyssen Harriman Bush family's Union Banking Corporation was a primary element in the United States. And note that as part of the concretization of the results of World War II, basically German industrialists, and this again from Paul Manning's captured documents, were to continue to finance the Nazi Party, which would go underground. So again, when I talk about the underground Reich, I'm not whistling Dixie. I'm talking about something which is documented, and although it is not cropped up into the light of day nearly as often in the post-World War II period, it is something that exists. Again, from the documents. A smaller conference in the afternoon was presided over by Dr. Bosse of the German Armaments Ministry. It was attended only by representatives of Hecko, Krupp, and Reuchling. Of course, Krupp is now ThyssenKrupp, based in Lugano, Switzerland. That's part of the Bush family Nazi connection. Dr. Bosse restated Bormann's belief that the war was all but lost, but that it would be continued by Germany until certain goals to ensure the economic resurgence of Germany after the war had been achieved. He added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France. And using the book Unholy Alliance by Peter Lavenda, we've looked at the fact that a member of the Order, the American neo-Nazi group inspired by the Turner Diaries, specifically said that that group had received financing from, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America. Three guesses who that might have been. And again, same types of capital relationships were maintained in Japan, and in order to understand perhaps the most concrete manifestation of the institutionalization of the economic results of World War II is the automobile industry. Americans used to drive Chevys, Fords, etc. Now, in large measure, they're also driving, or instead, are driving Mercedes-Benz, now part of Daimler-Chrysler, no more Chrysler firm. They're driving Volkswagens, Porsches, Audis, BMWs, Mazdas, Hondas, Toyotas. And again, look at the automobile industry, and that's perhaps the most concrete manifestation in everyday life of the relationships that I'm discussing here. Turning to the book Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, also authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, one of the manifestations of the realization of the economic results of World War II in Asia became evident when a group of POWs and former comfort women who had been abused by the Japanese sued many of the Japanese zaibatsu in order to obtain compensation for the slave labor, and American diplomats basically frustrated that lawsuit and worked against it, and it's to be noted that many of these diplomats had strong economic relationships with the very Japanese corporations that were focal points of the suit. Turning now to Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, the real issue is conflict of interest. During the Clinton administration, U.S. Ambassador to Japan Thomas Foley was adamant in rejecting compensation for POWs and other slave laborers, insisting that, quote, the peace treaty put aside all claims against Japan, unquote. His deputy chief of mission, Christopher J. LaFleur, echoed this dogma at every opportunity. It was a matter of some interest to victims that Foley's wife was a well-paid consultant to Sumitomo, one of Japan's biggest zaibatsu conglomerates, heavily involved in wartime slave labor and a target of the lawsuits. The moment Foley ended his tenure as ambassador and returned to America, he signed on as a paid advisor and lobbyist to another huge conglomerate, Mitsubishi, one of the biggest wartime users of slave labor. Of greater significance, perhaps, is that LaFleur is married to the daughter of former Prime Minister and Finance Minister Miyazawa, one of the three Japanese who secretly negotiated the 1951 treaty with John Foster Dulles. Miyazawa also is considered by Professor Lossier and others to be the financial overseer of the M Fund. Conflict of interest does not seem to be an obstacle in diplomatic appointments to Tokyo. Well, again, it is those structural economic relationships that have dictated much of what has been taking place. Now, I mentioned earlier that I don't believe the, quote, U.S. imperialism, unquote, is really the best way to understand what is taking place. I do think that elements within the petroleum industry very much want to exploit American military power in order to get their hands on some of the oil fields in the Middle East. But one of the most important things to understand as we look at what is taking place is that what is taking place is really the subversion of and destruction of the United States. And I'm encouraging people here to consider the economic implications of what is taking place. In For the Record 412, The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train, we looked at ruminations by not only Paul Krugman of the New York Times, but also by the Financial Times of London, that in fact something I had been stating, which was that this administration of the right-wing Republicans intended to deliberately subvert the economic America's economic position in order to precipitate social crises and the elimination of social programs that they knew would not be eliminated under normal circumstances. It is in that context that I believe the behavior of the American power elite in the contemporary period and the behavior of the French power elite in the run-up to and during World War II are analogous, that they're not really out to expand and enforce the position of those countries, but to subvert it. And in the context of globalization, one should understand that when the warm and brown hits the fan, it isn't going to be them who are suffering. They will go off to their mountain chalet in Aspen or over in Switzerland or on their house on the Riviera or in the Caribbean. And we, those of us here in the United States, will eat it raw. And I believe that it is in the context of the globalized economy that the United States is facing subversion. And I suspect that the architects of the Underground Reich and the Underground Axis are looking, they've studied their history. They've studied their von Clausewitz, their Sun Tzu, their Machiavelli. I also think they've studied Thucydides' history of the Peloponnesian War. That was the war between Athens and Sparta, which ultimately resulted in the disintegration of Greece. But specifically, it was Athens' expeditionary force sent to capture Syracuse, something that was viewed with great favor by the Athenian elite, that ultimately led to disaster and the economic and political subversion of Athens, which then lost to Sparta. So consider what is taking place in the United States in economic context. First of all, consider the effect of the terror scares on the airline business. And bear in mind that as we looked at in For the Record 407, there's a big struggle, just as there is a struggle between the euro and the dollar in with regard to the pricing of oil, so too there's a struggle between the euro and the dollar in the pricing of airframes. San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, January 3rd of 2004, carries a New York Times story, Terror Scares Hit Airlines. The rash of holiday flight cancellations, security actions, and terrorism warnings are going to compel many U.S. companies to reassess whether to send employees abroad in coming weeks, not only out of fear of attack, but because of the inconvenience of canceled and delayed flights, business travel experts said Friday. Kevin Mitchell, chairman of the Business Travel Coalition, said bookings could drop 10 to 15% after the latest incidents. That would be particularly bad news for the airlines, which have lost business travelers, who usually pay the highest fares and account for a disproportionate share of airlines' profit, since the industry's peak in the year 2000, well before the September 11th attacks. Dwindling business travel was a big reason that airlines had their lowest ever revenues last year. Skipping down, according to Robert Mann Jr., an industry consultant at Port Washington, New York, the psychological damage could not be discounted. From an industry-wide level, this throws cold water on revenue growth, unquote. It'll be interesting to see who benefits, perhaps the German government-subsidized Lufthansa Corporation. Note also the economic effect of the terror warnings on municipalities. This is a Reuters story from the Yahoo website, Cash-Strapped Cities Grapple with Security Costs. It's by Carolyn Dries, dated December 22nd of 2003. For cash-strapped U.S. cities and states, this week's heightened national alert level has reignited concerns about costs alongside fears of a new terror attack. Skipping down. Lifting the level triggers a raft of automatic additional federal security precautions and serves as a guideline for cities and states. Quote, we need to recognize that every time the government ratchets up the threat level, We forced the state and local government officials to make a choice, said analyst David Heyman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Randy King, spokesman for the city of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, all of it costs money, lots of money, and there's no federal reimbursement. Well, you don't slash revenues, as I've said in many programs, FDR 407 and 412. No world leader has ever slashed revenues while waging war. That is a blueprint for national suicide, and I think it's in that regard that the Bush administration and its behavior are analogous to the behavior of the French power elite in World War II. This isn't a blueprint for American empire. This is a blueprint for American subjugation and destruction. Paul Krugman of the New York Times discussed the economic implications of this. January 6, 2004, Rubin gets shrill. Argentina retained the confidence of international investors almost to the end of the 1990s. Analysts shrugged off its large budget and trade deficits. Business-friendly, free-market policies would, they insisted, allow the country to grow out of all of that. But when confidence collapsed, that optimism proved foolish. Argentina, once a showpiece for the New World Order, quickly became a byword for economic catastrophe. So what? Those of us who have suggested that the irresponsibility of recent American policy may produce a similar disaster have been dismissed as shrill, even hysterical. But few would describe Robert Rubin, the legendary former Treasury Secretary, as hysterical. His ability to stay calm in the face of crises and reassure the markets was his greatest asset. And Mr. Rubin has formally joined the coalition of the shrill. In a paper presented over the weekend at the meeting of the American Economic Association, Mr. Rubin and his co-authors, Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution and Alan Sinai of Decision Economics, argue along lines that will be familiar to regular readers of this column. The United States, they point out, is currently running very large budget and trade deficits. Official projections that this deficit will decline over time aren't based on credible assumptions. And the column goes on to describe what may very well result in an economic disaster for the United States. In that context, consider another article from the New York Times from January 8th of 2004, this by Elizabeth Becker and Edmund L. Andrews. IMF says U.S. debts threaten world economy. Dateline Washington, January 7th. With its rising budget deficits and ballooning trade imbalance, the United States is running up a foreign debt of such record-breaking proportions that it threatens the financial stability of the global economy, according to a report released Wednesday by the International Monetary Fund. These articles, by the way, will be reproduced at greater length in the description to this show. Consider in this context the views of Karl von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian military theoretician, who developed his concept of total war. From the Encyclopedia Britannica's 1997 edition, Clausewitz was a Prussian general whose writings, especially on war, advocated the concept of total war, in which all the enemy's territory, property, and citizens are attacked, skipping down. On war has had a profound influence on modern strategic concepts. Its most significant single contribution is the doctrine of political direction in military matters. In maintaining that, quote, war is nothing but a continuation of political intercourse with the admixture of different means, unquote, he denied that war is an end in itself. And ultimately, it is that interrelationship between war and economics, and something we discussed at great length in For the Record 367, 366 and 367 that have produced what is taking place. That from Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, jumping to the Washington Post of April 29th of 2002. Bank Altaqua's Ahmed Huber, one of the Nazi Islamist links that we've spoken about, had this to say, quote, by Huber's account, a group of aging SS officers and members of Hitler's personal guard who meet every few weeks in the German state of Bavaria for beer and conversation recently bestowed the title Honorary Prussian on bin Laden. They praised his valiant fight against the United States, Huber said. One of the members called Huber after the meeting to tell him that henceforth they had decided to call the Al-Qaeda leader Herr von Laden, Huber said. That concludes For the Record, Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 441, Pecunia Nervous Belly, Part 2, being recorded on January 11th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.